I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This place is special.
Get asked all the time, where's your favorite place to take college game day? And I say every time, Eugene, Oregon. Yes. This is the best crowd, honestly, it's 6 in the morning here.
Yeah.
It's dark. Yeah. It's raining. They don't care.
No, they don't.
These fans right here, pound for pound, are as good as any college football fans in the country.
This program is staged to compete and to win championships.
Oregon is going to be in the championship game.
When we watch this film, does our effort beat theirs?
Here's Bo Nix, guns it! Touchdown, Oregon!
Been making deposits, time to cash a check.
Sound at Austin, which is deafening for an Oregon 15-point win. Chip Kelly still does not have a win against his former school, and we say farewell.
Man, it feels great to be a Duck.
Welcome to the QB11 Show, presented by Scoop Duck. With Doug, Andrew, and J-Hop, here are the guys with the latest scoop.
Hello, and welcome back one more time to the QB11 Show, presented by Scoop Duck. I am Doug Scott, joined, of course, by QB11. Andrew, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I might sound a little funny. I've been battling a little bit of a head cold here the last 4 or 5 days, so apologize for that. And if I have to mute it up a couple times to sneeze or cough or something, I'll try to keep my finger on that button so the listeners don't have to deal with that crap.
Yeah, unacceptable.
Other than that, hey, you know what? I'm like the mailman. Rain nor sleet nor snow nor cold nor nothing's going to keep me away from this podcast.
No, you're the best, and I appreciate your commitment, and if you need me to carry the torch tonight or do anything extra, you just let me know, and I got you. But I know you're also coming off the high of the coaches' clinic this weekend.
Yeah, no, a second year in a row I've been down there to the Oregon coaches' clinic, and they just do an incredible job, especially because I think this is the – I don't know if they did one their first year. Did they do one – it would have been on a pretty short turnaround, but certainly I went last year, and their turnout was about double this year. So they had 200 spots and they filled them all. A lot of coaches from the West Coast, you know, a lot of California coaches and other places are there. Really, it's not about recruiting though. And Dan, that was the first thing Dan said when he kicked it off, is like, look, you know, some of you guys might have players we're interested in, but this is not, it's not what this weekend's about. This weekend's about, you know, sharing ideas with you, hearing your ideas, you know, like if there's good ideas, like they can come from anywhere. They can come from a middle school coach, a high school coach, you know, small college, big college, like we want them all. So, you know, don't be afraid to share your thoughts with us. And that's really what the weekend was about. They had some great speakers in, obviously Urban Meyer. I think that's been pretty well publicized. He spoke to the team after practice on Thursday, and then spoke to the coaches at the clinic that night for about an hour and a half. Really good kind of message on like building your culture, building your team, toughness. His, you know, one thing he repeated is over again was the toughest team always wins, you know, and that's just not just physical toughness, but mental toughness, perseverance, you know, everything, right? The team's got to be together. They all got to be, you know, committed to each other, and they've got to be tough, and that's the team that's going to win. And he said, you know, I went home after practice on Thursday and I went to the hotel, and I kind of wrote down a list of teams that I thought could win the national title this year. And there's about 8 teams on that list, and Oregon was one of them. And but what's going to separate, you know, Oregon from the other seven, or one of those seven from the rest, right? And who's going to end up hosting that trophy at the end of the year? And it's the team that's the toughest and the team that's the most together. And, you know, Urban knows a thing or two about winning titles. He's got three of them.
Yeah. And I think that, like, again, for Dan to be able to enhance the clinic by having like a coach of Urban's caliber there, I think speaks to a lot of the pull that Dan has, right? Because that guy, I'm sure, is welcome at every clinic in the country.
Yeah, no, it was great. And then, you know, you also had an NFL coach there, Patrick Toney, coaches DBs for the Arizona Cardinals. That was a, you know, pretty fun listening. And obviously, you know, I'm sure the coaches that are at the clinic are taking a lot more away from that, right? And how they can go apply that to their day to day, whether it be high school, college, or whatever. But as an observer, like, it's really impressive, you know, listening to these coaches talk. And then, quite frankly, you know, Coach Brian Mikalski, the linebackers coach for Oregon, gave a presentation on Friday afternoon, and Coach Drew Merringer gave another presentation on Friday afternoon, and they were incredibly impressive. You know, really just breaking down how Oregon approaches their game day prep, opponent prep, and how they watch the opponent film, put that together, you know, diagnose tendencies, and then really plan their game plan, especially on offense, right, to manipulate the opponent tendencies against them. I know every staff in the country is doing this stuff, right? Like, this is not some special, unique secret sauce to Oregon, but it's really cool to see it play out there, right? And I thought both Coach Mikalski and Coach Merringer were really solid in the way that they were able to communicate that information, you know, to the coaches, which means they're also able to communicate that information to the players. And for me, as someone who's, you know, just me, right? But I'm able to grasp the concepts they're talking about and understand what they're communicating. I'm like, okay, well, if I can figure this out, that tells me that the way that they're communicating this information to the players is also very effective.
Yeah, 100%. I think that you probably have similar understanding of the game to a freshman player. I don't mean that to be like disrespectful. Like, no, I would be the same way, right? And so the effectiveness in which these high level coaches who have forgotten more football than you and I will ever learn can communicate it to a layman is also how they're going to communicate it to their players, right? At least that they're freshmen, they're young guys that aren't as well versed yet in ball. And so I think that is like something that's worth calling out, right? Like, if you can communicate in that environment with coaches, then you can communicate with anybody, and specifically your players, which is really the most important thing.
Yeah, we got a couple other glimpses of that. You know, obviously I'm not going to go into any details and give away any inside info here, but, you know, listening to Tosh and Will Stein both, you know, talking to their units on Friday morning. So Thursday and Saturday were practice days. Friday was a walkthrough day, but they have unit and positional meetings, you know, on Friday morning. So the whole offense, so they kind of do it, they split it, right? So the entire defense is in the weight room lifting. The offense has their team meetings. So the whole offense meets. Will Stein goes for about 15, 20 minutes, really breaking down kind of twofold, right? Breaking down film of the previous day's practice, and also breaking down the concepts they're going to cover in today's practice, right? And all of this is review, because all of this has been fed to the players the day before. Right? It's incredible when you see one of these high-level operations, right? They got four, five, six cameras out on the practice field. And by 4 hours after practice, all that film is in the coach's hands. All the assistants, analysts are cutting it up, right? Player by player by player, unit by unit by unit. You know, the coaches make their own comments on it. It goes out to the players' iPads, right? So they're all, and then they get the next day's plan, right? So the players should be at home at night, you know, Thursday night. They're seeing the reviews of what they did. Well, actually, they had a team meeting Thursday night to kind of review. But even then, they get the plan for the next day. They got study the playbook and everything, and then they come in Friday morning. Stein walks through everything, and then they break up into their individual position groups, and the individual position coaches kind of walk through, you know, all the film to the players, talk about you know, things they did well, things they need to improve on, what they're going to work on today. You know, so I got to see both Will and Tosh, and again, like, very engaging, very interactive. The players are all, it's not just talking to them, right? They're put on the spot constantly. They're being quizzed. You know, their names are just called out, right? What do we do on this play? You know, what are we doing here? What did you do there? What's the next thing that's going to happen after we call this, right? When do we want to shift out of, you know, this play call to that play call based on what we're seeing on the other side of the ball, right? And they're just constantly quizzing the players. But it's also communicated in a way that even I could understand. So it's pretty impressive how much information they're able to communicate in such a short amount of time in practice, and then and certainly in the pre and post practice meetings that they have with the players. And then, you know, we got to see the, you know, when they broke out in individual units, then I spent a little bit of time with the running backs room, running backs and Rashad Samples. I spent a little bit of time with Junior Adams and the receivers. Got a little bit of time with Coach Hampton and the DBs as well. And, you know, this staff is incredible. This staff is unbelievable. I mean, top to bottom, they're really good coaches, teachers, communicators. They're very, very good at what they do, and it shows.
Yeah. I think that when we look at, like, the different iterations of the staff under Dan Lanning, I think this has to be considered the strongest one, right? Like, you have guys, I mean, people forget, like, Drew Mehringer, because he coaches tight ends, but he was one of the youngest. I think he might have actually been the youngest offensive coordinator in Power 5 at one point when he was at Rutgers. He has play calling and game plan experience. You have Will Stein, who's one of the hottest offensive coordinators in the game. You have Rashad Samples, who was the co-OC at Arizona State and likely will be an offensive coordinator at the Power 5 level in the next 2 to 3 years. Like, there really isn't on this offensive staff, you don't really have, like, a hole where you have a guy who was, like, out of his depth or is just, like, a position coach or just a recruiter. You have a bunch of really high-level coaches. And then on the defensive side of the ball, I mean, Coach Hampton received multiple SEC defensive coordinator offers, not co-DC, but, like, full-blown DC offers, which I think says a lot about, like, how in demand and how well-respected he is as a coach. And so, like, the whole staff is like that. I mean, Talia Tosh, who's worked everywhere. And I think that shows up.
Let me just say this about Tosh. Sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to say this about Tosh. You know, there's a lot of people out there. There's a lot of Oregon fans out there and fans of other programs that slander his coaching ability. That guy knows how to coach. And I challenge, you know, you just got to take my word for it, but I've now sat and listened to him at practice and at these team meetings now 3 years in a row. That guy can freaking coach, man. Like, I don't care what anyone says. Like, yeah, maybe wasn't a good DC at Alabama 10 years ago. But you know what? I'm a lot better at what I do now than I was 10 years ago. It's probably so are you. And so is everybody else who's striving to get better every day, right? And Tosh is not only hard, like, everyone on the staff, they're working to improve themselves every day too. But that guy knows how to teach. Like, the amount of information he communicates to his unit, you know, in a short amount of time, in a way that's easily understandable, the amount of passion he throws into it, the way he's on the field, like, go to a game, watch him pregame, just sit and go in as early as you can into the stadium and watch Tosh pregame and tell me he can't coach. That guy could coach, man. Sorry, go ahead and continue.
No, I mean, I agree. Like, really, that's kind of where I was going with this is, like, you have just a bunch of great, I mean, The whole Tosh can't coach thing has never made any sense to me because it's like, okay, well, you don't get hired in the NFL to be a recruiter. And that's also true of Coach Samples, right? Like, Coach Samples was also an NFL position coach. And so this idea that, like, oh, this guy is just is a recruiting merchant who's gotten promotions and gets paid all this money because that's what he can do is just not true. I mean, like, I think there's been times where I've been too hard on Tosh in the past. And, like, I would very gladly walk that back and admit that I was wrong. Like, he's a very good coach. And I think there's a lot of really good coaches on the staff. There's a lot of future head coaches and future coordinators on the staff, probably more than we've ever had. And so that's really where I was going. I was kind of running in circles trying to figure out how to articulate that. But ultimately, I just think that we have the highest quantity of future coordinators and head coaches that we've ever had on one staff.
Yeah, and like you said, there's guys who could probably do that right now and are choosing to be here instead because I think they know there's something special right here right now. That if they can all come together and, you know, and maximize their opportunity here, like this could be a really special place and a really special team, you know, this year's team, next year's team, whatever, but this program is in a really special place right now. And I think a lot of them recognize that, right? And sometimes a rung up the ladder isn't necessarily the right rung if it's at the wrong place at the wrong time, right? And I think some of those guys are seeing that. And I'll just double down on Hampton as well. I've had the opportunity to hear him speak 3 times now. And again, like incredibly impressive. You know, I sat and watched him spend 45 minutes walking, I don't know, 8 coaches in the room and plus me through how he teaches tackling to defensive backs specifically. And their approach to tackling, and he had a lot of clips in there. It was a lot of clarity in his community. I'm like, I can go out and run a tackling drill tomorrow now because of I'm able to assimilate this information that, and how effectively he's communicating it in this presentation. That is super impressive.
Yeah, and like while you're not going to be running a tackling drill tomorrow, I think like that that urge to understand and to learn only like enhances the product here on the podcast, which is why you're doing that. And obviously you love to see the team practice and do all those things as well. But like that deserves to be called out too. Like, thank you for investing your time and going to do this because I think it makes our product better. I know like you, every time you go, you learn a lot. I know every time I've ever gone, I've learned a lot. I'm pretty jealous that I didn't get the opportunity to go this year. So
we're getting you up next year. We're going to make it happen.
100% next year. I'll be there. But I'm just glad you were able to go.
Yeah, and I'm really, really grateful for the opportunity. And, you know, I think it's really invaluable. Obviously, as a fan, you know, getting some of the inside access is incredible. But also, you know, I have to treat that with the respect, right? I just can't come in here and tell everyone everything I saw because that's betraying the trust. You know, that's part of that deal. And so, you know, unfortunately, I can't share all of the inside intel and nuggets and information that I was able to observe because, you know, then I wouldn't be able to come back again and that wouldn't be right or fair to this program anyway. But I'm incredibly lucky and happy that I was able to see that. But the coaching clinic itself was just incredible as well. And I almost as good or better than, you know, some of the inside baseball stuff too.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. I know Oregon obviously is about halfway through spring ball now. They had a scrimmage on Saturday. Obviously, it's not open to the public, so we don't get a lot of details from there. It sounds like Dan said afterwards. First of all, I know it poured, so the rain was a pretty significant factor in that. I know Dan said afterwards that both the offense and defense had their moments. You know, certainly, I think early the offense was better, and then the defense, I think, you know, played a lot better after that and really limited the effectiveness of the offense. You know, I think there's a lot of depth on this team, as we've been saying, QB.
Yeah. I talking to you, talking to some other friends of ours who were in attendance or have seen practice this fall, I think the one thing that's clear is that this is the best roster that Oregon's ever had, 1 through 85, right? And would you agree with that after what you've seen?
Yeah, absolutely. And nearly every position group, I mean, you're looking at guys, you know, and they don't have a depth chart right now, right? Everybody's intermixing with everybody. But there's, you know, you look at a position group and there's 7 guys that can play here and there's only 2 starting spots, right? Or so, you know, there's guys that are going to be third or even fourth on the depth chart at certain position groups that could probably start somewhere or be in the rotation somewhere. I mean, it's an incredibly deep team at nearly every position across the board. And I remarked to somebody, you know, when I went to spring ball 2 years ago, you know, I know the roster pretty well, right? So I'd be walking by the offensive line group, for example, and you have a mix of scholarship players and you got a mix of walk-on players. Not a I knew which was which because I know the roster. But if you didn't know the roster, you wouldn't necessarily be able to tell 2 years ago by looking like which guys are scholarship. I mean, some of them you could, right? But there's probably a jumbling of that guy looks like pretty similar to that guy body-wise, right? And one's on scholarship and one's a walk-on. And no knock on walk-ons. These guys work their ass off. But that's just the reality of the situation. But now when you go, the walk-ons stand out. They stand out. You're like, oh, that guy, you know, there's a, like, you line up the offensive linemen and there's probably 17 of them on the roster, right? No, maybe more when you count the walk-ons, probably 20 of them. You could pretty easily just look at their bodies and say, those are the guys on scholarship and those are the guys that are walk-ons. Like, they're the difference in the physical attributes of the players is that stark. Now, again, I don't want to diss on walk-ons because some of those guys are working really hard and playing, you know, playing really well. And they're, you know, those are good players too. They could go some other place and probably be on scholarship at another school, right? But compared to the scholarship players on the offensive line at Oregon, it's night and day.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Yeah, and I think that we've been talking about this since they got hired, and there was a concerted effort on the trail, specifically on the front, to get longer and bigger. And like, we got heavier under Mari, but we didn't effectively get longer. And now you look at that defensive line room, you look at the edge room, and just the depth of length is insane. Like, there's just so many guys with great long frames. Projectable frames, and not only that, some of those guys are starting to come into their own now, which just puts Oregon in like an unbelievable position to, like, really, I think, start to assert themselves and show themselves to be one of the more elite programs in the country, because that has been the missing link for Oregon. That's been the thing that's been we haven't had that consistently. We'd have a guy or two, right? Like, we'd have a guy here or a guy there. That would fit the profile, but we would never have 10 guys, 8 guys, 7 guys, a real whole room. Like, I mean, based off the people I've talked to, I think Oregon's probably going to play somewhere between 12 and 15 guys in the defensive front this year in regular time. That's quite the change from, that's definitely quite the change over the last couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, before we move on real quick, and we'll have time to talk about this in more detail later on as the season goes, but, you know, when you go in the last few years, last 4 or 5 years, you know, it had always been to me pretty easy to set what I think would be a fair expectation for the team going into a season. Right. And my thought was always, okay, at a minimum, let's say since 2019, right? At a minimum, this team needs to be playing in the Pac-12 title game. Ideally playing in the Pac-12 title game with a chance to make the playoffs if they win. And then, you know, going to a major bowl game, right? Like, that to me has been kind of what is a fair expectation, right? And I think 2019, you know, that team, I think, met expectations. I think 2020 and 2021 fell short. And I think 22, yeah, it's the first year, new coaching staff. I think they fell a little short of expectations that year. I think last year's hard, right? I think they fell short of expectations, but that's also, I mean, this team went 11-1 in the regular season and 12-2 overall. So I don't know. But now with the expanded playoffs, 12-team field, don't necessarily have to make the conference title game to make the playoffs. Like, for you, for Oregon, and I want, the reason I bring this up, because you hear a lot of people saying, like, oh, well, make the playoffs is the goal, and that's not good enough for me for this year, for this team. What do you think is a fair goal for this year?
Early, well, as it is. I didn't have the benefit of seeing them, so I have to, like, take take your guys' word for it on this, and like frankly, like there's
you
no
know,
one else.
You know this roster. I mean,
no, yeah, know. I know the roster. So this is where I'm at. Like, I think this is a complete team. I think this is the type of team that can not only make a playoff but win it. And so for me, I think like making the playoff is an expectation. I think that putting yourself in a position to compete for the Big Ten titles, either being in Indy or being in that conversation late into the year, is an expectation. I would say like a lot of people say, oh, natty or bust. I'd say like semifinal or bust. Like I think that this is a this team should do no worse than make the college football playoff semifinal.
Yeah, I think I was saying quarterfinal. But now it doesn't mean I'd be happy with quarterfinal. But I don't think first round is enough, right? Like you can't make the playoffs and lose in the first round. Like that is a disappointing season for this roster and this program and where it's at. Now if you either get a bye. Well, if you get a bye and lose in round one, I don't know, that would be tough. But let's say you don't get a bye and you're the, you know, sixth seed, and you beat the 11th seed in your first game, and then you lose to the 3 seed. I don't know. I could probably live with that, but you got to make round two at a minimum, and then it depends on the matchups and injuries and everything else.
Yeah. I just this team just doesn't have the missing pieces that other Oregon teams in the past have had. I just think that the overall depth 1 through 85 is so good that it really is just going to come down to quarterback play. And I don't mean to put that much pressure on one person, but I kind of think that that's really what it is.
I think you might be right. I think you might be right.
And I think that, all right, I don't think it has to be one player, but I do think that the quarterbacks necessary to do this thing are in the room.
Well, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. All right. Let's spring game, by the way, in 12 days from now, or 13 days from now. So that'll be a lot of fun as well to watch them and the spring ball with that game here in a couple weeks. Let's move on. Cooper Perry committed to Oregon, a wide receiver out of your neck of the woods down there in Arizona. I think he had kind of been an Oregon lean for quite a while. It was Arizona State was also in the mix, funny enough. Rashawn Samples was leading his recruitment for Arizona State. So I think he was probably leading Oregon anyway, but when Rashad came over, that kind of sealed the deal, right?
Yeah. That was the end of that recruitment. This is a really nice pickup. I think that this was a guy that has been a priority. No, I don't think. I know this is a guy that has been a priority for this staff for a long time, well before Rashad Samples was ever even thought of to be the running backs coach at Oregon. I think that just kind of put the icing on the cake. Even if Sample stays at ASU, I think the outcome of this recruitment is the same. Now, the timeline in which that happens, who knows? I don't know the answer to that question, but regardless, this is a really nice pickup. Adding to the Vanilla Killas with Gatlin Bear from a year ago, another receiver that everyone will compare to Jeff Mail, but also a player that deserves a lot more credit than that. A very explosive athlete. National level lacrosse player. You can see that. Like I wrote this up on Scoop Duck. He has extremely like elite athletic body control and contact balance. When he gets the ball post catch, he's a very dynamic runner and ball carrier, but he has the athletic body control to change speeds, get in and out of his breaks, like run vertical routes, run intermediate. He can go outside his frame and make contested catches. There's really not a piece of his game that's missing, in my opinion. And I think this is like a well-rounded receiver that will be a contributor at some point. I don't know when, but because the room is really, really deep now, I think that's something that we could probably talk about a little bit too. But I think this is a guy that can actually play for us, and that's with our receiver room elevating.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take your word for it. I don't evaluate players, as I always say, and I certainly haven't watched his film, but the fact that the staff is high on him and is willing to take his commitment, you know, this early in the cycle, I think says everything you need to know about how they feel about him. And this is a staff that is recruiting that position, you know, at an extremely high level. So, and there's a lot of big fish, you know, out there for Oregon in that group. So they obviously like this guy a lot.
Yeah. And there's really like, if I was to ask you like, hey, like, what do you look for in a receiver? Like what skill set can you not like what are the things that they have to be able to do? Like, there's really nothing he can't do. Like, there's nothing on that list that Gatlin Bear can't, or not Gatlin Bear, that Cooper Perry, that doesn't do me a lot of good when I'm just comparing all the wide receivers to each other. But there's no skill set that's missing, right? Like, he can run the vertical, he can go up and make contested catches, he's really quick in and out of his breaks. If you wanted to play him in the slot, you could absolutely do that. He's dynamic post catch if you want him in the screen game. He's a physical player, he can block on the perimeter. There's not a missing skill set. Like, some guys, like, okay, well, he's just a slot guy, or oh, he's a big outside guy, but he might struggle against press because of either he lacks quickness or he's not very strong. I think that Cooper Perry can play literally anywhere in the receiver room and excel in doing whatever it is that the play calls for.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds incredible to me. That Oregon has two receivers in this class now, obviously with Cooper Perry and Dallas Wilson, who, as we know, is going to be a dogfight to hold on to from Florida. I know all the Florida schools are heavy on him right now, but he's coming back out to Oregon again soon, and he's. Oregon has his commitment right now, so they're in the pole position, as you say. And then obviously, DeCorian Moore is another one that's going to be visiting again soon. The LSU commit that again is another one that Samples might be able to help Junior Adams out with as well. And I know Junior, obviously the work he's done on the trail the last several cycles speaks for itself too.
Did you just make a Formula One reference with the pole position, Damon?
Way back before your time, QB, there was this awesome arcade game called Pole Position that you first played in the actual arcade back in the day. You didn't have home video game. I know this is dating myself, but if you could imagine a world where you didn't, there was no such thing as a Nintendo or a Sega or an Xbox or a PlayStation, and you had to actually go to an arcade, which was it was like a place where they'd have all these video games, and you'd have to put quarters in them. And
I'm younger than you, but I'm not five. Like, I've been to arcades before.
Like, so there was a cool arcade game called Pole Position, which also they ported to the Atari. So when I was a kid in the 80s, I had an Atari 2600, and one of my favorite games was Pole Position. I don't know anything about
it. I just think it's funny because you and I were talking about earlier about, like, I had mentioned, like, hey, I asked you, have you ever played Civilization, the video game? And you're like, yeah, I played the first and second ones. I was like, okay, man, I'm just learning how to play.
I've been playing that game since before you were born, man.
Yeah, I know. Come on. And I'm sorry for being a noob and not knowing these things, but I think it's funny.
It's an all-time classic, for sure. Both of those games are. But yeah, I did make a Formula One reference, I suppose. So there you go.
I'm proud of you.
Happy. Made you smile for the day.
It's a good sport.
Wait, racing is not a sport.
Okay, well, we're not going to get into that argument right now.
It's a skill.
Another time.
I can't bait you into this one?
Nope, not. No, I think you might have been able to, like, get Hifla Day, but not me.
Okay. All right, another time we will debate we should have a whole episode where we bring up every possible thing and say sport, not sport, right? And
we'll go through them all.
That would be fun.
But I think that I'm going to be different than you. I think I'm actually going to be very liberal with naming things sports.
Like, I have a more conservative definition, so it'll be fun. Let's do that. We'll chalk that up.
That's a good off-season content.
We have dog days of summer or something. Yeah.
Yes, that's good.
All right, let's move on then. Cooper Perry is a Duck. That's great news. And we'll watch how this class, and as we've talked about, now we're in the prime commitment season, right? We're entering it now through summer, right, is when you're going to start seeing a lot of players come off the board around the country to Oregon and other schools as well. Yeah, look forward to watching that unfold. All right, QB, let's move on. NFL has made some pretty wild rule changes this offseason. I'm not, as many people may be aware, not an avid NFL watcher. I watch an occasional game here or there. I mostly follow it for fantasy football purposes. I used to, back growing up as a kid, I was a diehard NFL fan in the 80s and 90s. And then as my love for college football grew bigger and bigger, my passion for NFL football got smaller and smaller. And it's now more of a casual observer of the NFL. But they did make a couple of interesting rule changes I wanted to talk with you about. So, you ready for this?
Yeah, I already know one of them and I hate it.
Yeah, let's talk about that one first because I think that's the easy one. The ban of the hip drop tackle. I'm blown away by this.
I don't know how you officiate that without bias.
I don't know how you tackle someone from behind now. You're just going to have to let them score.
I don't think anyone does it with the intent of hurting somebody. Like, I mean, maybe they're, I don't know, like Vontaze Burfict was a player that I thought
That guy's always trying to hurt. I mean, that guy's been doing that crap since college.
Yes, but like I don't think that the majority of players are tackling in a way that is meant to injure the person they're tackling. And so, like,
how many players have been hurt by this style of tackle?
There's been a few, but there's also been a lot of guys who haven't been hurt. I think that the thing is that they recognize the risk involved in that type of tackle. But I just don't know what you replace it with. How do you tackle guys that you're chasing?
Yeah. So can you describe what a hip drop tackle is?
Basically, you grab the leg, you throw your hip into the ankle, and you just use your body weight to drag a guy down. But the problem with that is that because your hip is like either in the knee or the ankle, there's a chance that their leg gets caught and gets like hyperextended or bent in a weird way, right? And again, like I don't think you, me, anybody is calling for that, right? Like none of us want guys to get tackled in dangerous ways that could potentially get them hurt. But I just don't, like, how many ways are there to tackle? You can't lead with the helmet anymore. You're supposed to have the helmet on the backside leg. Well, if you have your helmet on the backside leg, then is there
where's your hip gonna go?
Yeah, like I don't know. I just think that this is, you're adding subjectivity to the officiating, and whenever you add subjectivity to the officiating, you're creating room for the officials to dictate the outcome of the game, which to me ruins the competitive integrity of the sport.
Yeah, I don't know what to think about this one a lot. I've heard NFL people, like, you know, people that are like a lot of former players are just adamantly against this. They think it's going to significantly hurt the sport. Even offensive players have come out and said, this is ridiculous. Like, this is, you know, this isn't, I don't know how we're supposed to play this game with this rule. And I think, like, a lot of these things, it's going to come down to, like you said, how is it officiated? How, you know, are they going to start off in preseason and be like, everything's a hip drop tackle, and then by week five of the regular season, nobody's calling it anymore? Or it's going to be like super sporadic. And so then it's like, oh, well, you know, all game long, nobody called this. And all of a sudden on the critical tackle of the game, somebody gets a 15 yard penalty and keeps the drive alive and wins because of it. I don't know. That's the stuff that's, I think, going to create a lot of controversy and unhappiness.
Yeah. I just, again, like if you add subjectivity, it's kind of like the targeting rule. Like when it gets called for your team's benefit, it's fine. When it gets called against your team, it's the greatest travesty in the history of sport. And so, like, why are we giving?
But at least the targeting rule has real substance behind it. I love the way that the rule is written and enforced necessarily, but the intent behind it makes sense.
Yeah, the intent's fine. I don't think the intent behind any of these rules is bad. I don't think that, like, they're doing this to ruin the game. I just don't think they understand the consequences of what they do. And I also don't think that they actually think about the practical implementation and how it's going to be officiated and how the fact that the truth is, and there's really no way to avoid this. And if someone thinks or can point me to how this is avoidable, I'd love to see it. Like, how you're not putting the game in officials' hands in a more substantial way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely agree with that one.
Which is absolutely not the, like, that's the worst thing for the game. Like, I think we can all agree on that. Like, officials, I mean, yes, we're not in that garbage conference anymore, but it's still much better to not have the game in their hands.
So can we agree we do not want to see this rule come to college football?
No, I would hate to see this rule in college football. I think this would be very, 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 very bad.
Especially with the much more inconsistency in officiating right across the sport. I mean, it would be that much worse. Well said. Okay, let's move on to the other one that maybe is a little bit more, difference of opinion here. So the kickoffs in the NFL are changing drastically. They're essentially adopting kind of the experiment, or a version of the experiment that the XFL put in place a couple of years ago. I might not have all the exact specifics right, but the general parameters of what I'm about to say are accurate. So the way it works is the kicker will kick off now from, I think it's the 20 or 25 yard line, right? So they're moved back another 5 to 10 yards. And then the return people are, down at their 5 or 10. And then I think you can have 2 returners down there. And then all of the kickoff coverage team is lined up essentially right around the 50. The other 9 members of the kick return team are lined up like within 10 yards of those players, right? So now, now where you have to have 5 guys up close to the kickoff, now you actually have to have all 9 up close to the kickoff. And then what happens is that when the kick happens, then you don't have these people sprinting full speed at each other for 40 yards straight and having these massive collisions, right? It's almost more like a scrimmage play in that the kick coverage team and the kick return team are only separated by about 10 yards when the ball's kicked. So they meet much sooner at much less impact. So it's a safety injury reduction thing primarily, but it also is meant to encourage actual more kickoff returns, because so much now in the NFL and college too, but even more so in the NFL, everything's just a touchback. I think the Super Bowl had 13 touchbacks, not a single kick return. And so they want to have more excitement back in that play. And so they move the kick back. And then the other thing is, if the kicker still kicks it out of the end zone, it actually is kind of like kicking it out of bounds, and that the ball gets placed, I think it's at the 30 or 35, right? So that the kicker is actually encouraged to land the ball in what they call the like landing zone, which is between the goal line and the 20 yard line, I think. And then a return will ensue. So there's an actual penalty for kicking it through the end zone for a touchback.
Yeah.
What do you think of this?
I actually think this removes injury. And like when I think my generation was probably the last generation to have the hard ass coach that was like, as long as you hit them harder than they hit you, it doesn't hurt, right? Like on kickoff, and like they're bad being shit. We still had wedges, right? And like the wedge is gone, thankfully. And I think that's something that's like very good for player safety, because like, the bigger and stronger these players get, the more risk there is in injury with these. When you have freaking grown men running, high performance athlete grown men running 40 yards in a straight line at each other, trying to blow each other up, like that's where I think you're going to have substantial injury, or at least risk for injury. I don't know there's a real safe way to get away with it now. So this is a rule change that I actually like hope works, and I hope it makes the game more exciting, because we get more returns.
Now the one downside of it is that it doesn't allow for like onside kicks, or certainly not surprise onside kicks. And so the way the NFL is implementing this, which I absolutely hate, is that you're only allowed to do an onside kick, I think it's in the fourth quarter, and you can only do it if you're behind. And you basically have to declare, we're doing an onside kick, and then you line it up like the traditional way, and everyone knows an onside kick is coming. So you can't do like the middle of the first half, you spotted something and you do a surprise onside kick and maybe steal a possession. And that part of the rule I don't like.
No, I'm not a fan of that. But like when you have, I mean, like what's the options, right?
I actually listened to another podcast, and I can't remember which one it was, or I would credit them. But I think there was two options I heard that were thrown out as alternatives in that scenario. And one of them was being more like, instead of doing this XFL style kick, what if you just did a like a punt, and the punt's live. So you could kind of do sort of an onside punt, if you will. The other idea, which I actually think is really interesting, is at any point in the game, any team can say, we want to do a quote-unquote onside kick, but instead of it being an onside kick, you basically set up a a fourth down scenario, right? You figure out what the yardage is you want it to be, right? How often do you want these things to be successful? So maybe it's a fourth and 15, maybe it's a fourth and 20, maybe it's a fourth and 10. And you basically say, okay, if you convert that, you get the ball. If you don't, the other team gets the ball. And as an alternative to the onside kick. And I think that's kind of an interesting concept, honestly. And that's more exciting anyway. Then the onside kick is always kind of random anyway.
Yeah, I mean, especially when both teams know it's coming, it's not, I don't think, something that's like, I guess there's skill involved in it, but I don't know that it's like really skill-driven.
I think there's a lot of luck in how the ball ends up bouncing. I mean, there's certainly kickers that are better than others at giving, but they're not even... There's even a lot of randomness for every kicker, right? I don't know. I kind of like the idea of like, oh, okay, you know what? I want to have a chance to get a steal a possession here. We're going to go for it, and you set up a fourth and 15. Let's say, I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think that's although
especially like, in college, especially special, in college, you're not going to see pro calls do that. But
no, but like special teams has been somewhere where like certain programs and schools have had an advantage. And if you just make it another offensive play, like you're just pandering to the teams with good offense.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't know. I haven't thought through this all that well or much, but that's my...
Would you like to see this rule come to college?
Not... I don't know. Again, like I'm all for player safety, but I do like... The college game is where special teams, I think, are actually way more of an edge than the NFL.
Right.
Like the team, like there's like, look at Iowa, like they're just special teams in defense and they win. Well, in the past, they won 10 games a year. They're probably going to win like 7 or 8 now. But so I don't know. I'm kind of impartial on this one. There's people that are a lot more qualified than me on this topic.
Yeah, I like the kickoff. Like, I think that sounds like you said, I think the injury reduction factor is great. And I think it sounds like, hey, more returnable kicks is exciting, right? That's kickoff returns are much more exciting than watch the ball go out of the end zone and everybody trot off the field, right?
Unless you're the team kicking off. Like, I prefer to just have the offense start at the 25, you know what I mean?
Well, that's the interesting part about the penalty part, right? So if you're a coach and you're like, okay, even if you give them the ball at the 30 by kicking it out through the end zone, I'd still probably do that more often than not, right? Because the alternative is, you know, what if this guy returns it, you know, to the 40 or all the way?
Yeah.
I don't know. So it's interesting. Yeah, I don't think I'm ready to see this in college. I don't think the touchback percentage in college is as high as it is in the NFL. I don't know about the injury numbers on kickoffs. I know they're higher than the general average play. I don't know to what extent, but maybe I'd like to see this happen for a couple of years in the NFL before I'm ready to see it come to college.
But yeah, I would agree with that.
So
let them beta test it for the best, because like there's no question that the NFL is better football, but like the best product is college. And so I would rather not see it messed with in that way without some kind of like sample size to give us an idea of what is good, right or wrong. You know what I mean?
Totally agree. I did think it would be fun though, QB. What are some rule changes and they could be, you know, bringing something from the NFL to college, or they could be coming up with some new rule entirely that we like, but I thought it'd be fun if we maybe batted around a couple of ideas that we would, if we were the czar of college football, that we would want to see come to college. Can you?
Yep. I would get rid of targeting.
Yeah. I don't know that I would get rid of targeting. I would change the penalty.
I'd shoot it in outer space. I'd get rid of it forever.
I would certainly get rid of the, like, I don't think anyone should miss any part of a following game. Right. I'd actually almost say, I don't even think someone should necessarily be ejected. You know, give him the 15 yards, but there's a reason. The guy doesn't need to get kicked out of the game. Like, and, you know, unless you go to a two-tier system where there's, like, malicious intent. Because the vast majority of targeting rules are not, I don't think, are somebody trying to target, right? Like, these are bang-bang plays. All of a sudden, the
it's football.
It is football, right? And the player who commits targeting is literally going for the torso of the offensive player, and then all of a sudden the offensive player changes his body position and now he hits his head instead. Well, he wasn't targeting the head. It wasn't intentional. It wasn't malicious. it's just football, and you know, like you can't necessarily change the momentum of your body. It's physics. It's not possible to do that in a split second when someone else makes that change in the momentum of their body.
And that's my point with all of this, is that it's not, I don't think it's about player safety. I think it's always been about lawsuits. And like,
I
think
why
that
never
like,
take it away.
If it was about making the game safer, I think they've already accomplished that. The game is already safer because I think that safe tackling is coached better than it was in the past, among other things. But I don't think that, I don't know. I don't subscribe to the idea that the targeting rule makes the game safer, because you're punishing someone retroactively after the hit. You're not actually changing the hit. The hit happens regardless.
Yeah, I kind of wish they would have implemented something where it was more of a judgment, right? Like if somebody is clearly going after somebody with some sort of malicious intent, then you hit them with an unsportsmanlike conduct or an unnecessary roughness or something, and you throw them out of the game if you want to. But like this idea that these like accidental bang-bang plays, you know, especially the absolute dumbest one, which I can't even still believe was ever part of the rule, was like when you accidentally brush the quarterback's helmet with your forearm as your hands are in the air to try to deflect the pass, and they come down and they tap the quarterback on the top of the helmet, and that's targeting. It's the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Like, yeah. Nobody's getting hurt because the forearm hits your helmet.
No. Well, I mean, maybe, but like, you're also playing a contact sport. Like, this is you're not playing, like, we're not playing croquet. We're this is a collision sport, not a contact sport. Basketball is a contact sport. You're playing a collision sport. So like, you sign up to play. Everyone that plays is playing mostly because they like the collisions, right? Like, because they enjoy that aspect of the game. They enjoy the physicality of the game. And so like, you're not going to ever be able to legislate out tackling and hitting and collisions from a collision sport. And sometimes it feels like that is what they're trying to do. And I just think that that's silly.
All right, let's go out. Let's go after a couple ones that are differences between NFL and college. And let's start with the catch. Two feet inbounds, 1 foot inbounds. What do you like better?
I like one.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. I actually think one leads to more acrobatic and impressive catches, right? Like, and I think one should be enough, right? You have possession of the ball, your foot is in bounds. Like, I like the college rule. I would not like to see them change it to the NFL version of two.
No, I think like you said, I think it lends itself to more, I think, crazy catches. I would agree with that.
The other one I think college has right, and I hate the NFL rule, especially nowadays, is the pass interference penalty for defensive pass interference, spot foul versus the 15 yards. I could see on rare occasion where, you know, a late game scenario, somebody tackles the guy in, you know, to avoid a long pass and they only get 15 yards instead of 50. Okay, but those are pretty rare. I think so often now you just see these like, PI merchants in the NFL where they're just getting, you know, throwing up these bombs that have such an incredibly low probability of getting caught, but the receivers know how to run back through the defender and get the call and get 50 yards. It's just absurd. I love the call. I think college has got this one right.
Yeah, I do too.
All right. So is there any rules you would want to see outside of getting rid of targeting? Any other changes?
Again, I want the refs as little involved in the game as possible. So I'm never going to be a proponent of more rules in the sport.
Well, there could be less rules. Could be changed, like you mentioned, getting rid of targeting. Could be that too, or just change rules. In another sense, I think trying to think of some that we've seen. Could be clock rules or things like that. What about the hashes? You like?
I like the white hashes. I don't want to narrow the hashes. I think the white hashes make it more fun. I think it gives more, like, I want the game to be diverse, right? And like, if you narrow the hashes, I think it removes some of the diversity of the game from a schematic standpoint that exists. I would never be a proponent of that.
Yeah, I don't want I don't want college football to be the NFL, right? I think it's a uniquely different product, and they're both great in their own ways. But I like the college football product, and if it just became the NFL product from a rules standpoint, I think that we would lose a lot in that.
Yeah, that'd be a no.
Yeah, it'd be a big no for me too. All right. Well, if you can't think of anything else, we'll move on to the next topic.
This is not my strength. I think you know this about me.
Fair enough. I didn't give you a lot of lead time either, so my bad on that one. All right. We do have some listener questions we can end up with, QB. These are actually from like a month ago when we asked for them, and we never ended up having time to answer them. So we'll go with the ones that are still relevant, and we'll get through them and see where that leaves us. Sound good?
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Okay, first one. Which young defensive line that did not see a ton of snaps last year do you want or expect to take the next step and see meaningful snaps in 2024?
That we didn't see last year?
Yeah, young defensive lineman that did not see a lot of playing time last year.
Well, Amari Washington didn't see a lot of playing time, but I think he's going to play a massive role. Is that cheating?
No, I don't think that's cheating at all.
Then that'd be my first answer. And then I think, like if I was going to go with a guy that like we just like didn't see at all, and I think this will be a shock, I think like Jaden Moore is someone that I think will probably play quite a bit.
Yeah.
On the edge?
No, I think that's a guy that has seen some flashing in spring ball from what I've heard as well. Yeah, I think those are two good ones. There's going to be more, I think, no pun intended. I think there's going to be more, especially on the interior, that are probably going to get some playing time as well. Hard to say exactly who that would be outside of Amari Washington, but
I think Terrence Green is another one that will play a lot more. I mean, I think that it's probably not going to be a true freshman, right? Like, I think it'll probably be a redshirt guy that steps right up in that role. Who exactly?
I'd put might be cheating, but I think Blake Purchase as well is another one. I think he played less than both Mateo and Tatum Tuioti did, but he still played a meaningful amount. So I don't know if that counts or not, but I think he's going to take a step forward this year.
Yeah, I think that's a good one.
Ashton Porter might be another one. I mean, again, this goes back to the depth. There's just this. There's a lot of depth in that edge room now, particularly.
So, yeah, I mean, compared to where we were a couple of years ago, like when we lost KT, it was like, we have a half-eaten bag of Lay's potato chips and a half-smoked cigarette. And now Oregon's probably in a position where they'll have six or seven guys above the line next year. So, like, how things can change quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess two cycles. They change pretty fast. Next question. Similar. Just looking at the roster before spring ball, do you anticipate an improvement on the back end of the defense, particularly at the safety and nickel positions?
Yes. Massive. I think that the biggest difference between this team and last year's team will be the talent and depth and explosiveness on the defensive front, specifically on the edge, and then the secondary.
I think the secondary is going to be noticeably improved this year. And I do think particularly at the safety and nickel positions that are being asked about. I think the depth at those positions is maybe not as strong, especially at safety, maybe not as strong as corner, for example, which is just embarrassingly deep. At safety, we're probably not quite there depth-wise, but the guys who are playing are going to be better, noticeably better than the guys who were playing last year at those positions. And the nickel position, I think it's both. I think it's both better and deeper, and it certainly will be once Brandon Johnson gets to town as well. Between him and Dalen Austin and whoever else is playing the nickel position, it's going to be a significant improvement.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it's going to be a fun time to watch Oregon defense this year. I think this is the best defense we've ever had.
I mean, that's tall. I mean, that's a bold statement. You know, we had some pretty good defenses back there in, you know, 2010, 2012. Certainly more talented than those, but also, you know, we'll be playing stiffer competition across the board, I think, this year than those teams did as well. But yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, last year's defense made incredible improvement over the year before. I think last year's defense was probably pretty comparable to 2019. I think this year's defense will be better than last year's. What is your favorite underrated sports movie? I don't know what underrated means in this category. You can't name any kind of racing movie because that's not sports, but
fair. Well played. I can
respect
that.
You can't go with Talladega Nights is out. It's not a sports movie.
Okay, then another Will Ferrell flick. Kicking and Screaming.
Kicking? I don't know that I've seen that. What
is
it about?
Where he's the youth soccer coach?
I have not seen that. Is it good? Do I need to watch this?
It's freaking hilarious. Hey, you haven't seen Kicking and Screaming?
No, but I will tell you, Will Ferrell for me is either his movie, every Will Ferrell movie either falls into the 10 or the 0 category for me. Like, there's no middle ground. Like, it's either I love this movie or, oh my God, this is so garbage I can't even finish it. So
that's fair. I mean, I'm a big Will Ferrell guy. I enjoy
Anchorman,
that kind of
10. Old school 10. You know, there's a lot of 10s, but there's some duds in there too, and some that I would probably not be popular opinions for me to say. Like the aforementioned Talladega Nights. I couldn't finish it. It was so bad. I never watched that whole movie. I made it about 2/3 of the way through, and it was terrible. I turned.
Fair enough.
I know people who swear by that movie and think it's hilarious.
I think it's pretty funny.
I also am one who've watched Dumb and Dumber once, thought it was stupid, and never watched it again.
That is crazy to me, though. That's like something wrong with you.
No, there's humor that I like and there's humor that I don't, and I don't like Dumb and Dumber style humor.
I don't know. I think that's like peak Jim Carrey.
I mean, there's a lot better Jim Carrey movies than that one. But
what's your favorite? Okay, before we go way too far, we don't have to go crazy off topic here, but I am curious what your favorite Jim Carrey movie is.
I loved Liar Liar. I thought that was hilarious. I was a big, like, the first Ace Ventura is pretty good. I feel like I'm missing some.
There you are. Dumb and Dumber. Yeah.
What's yours?
Sorry.
No, I'm not missing that one at all. He was kind of like Will Ferrell to me, kind of hit and miss.
Yeah, I would agree. I like Liar Liar, but I think that my favorite Will Ferrell movie is Dumb and Dumber. Or not Will Ferrell. Jim Carrey movie is Dumb and Dumber.
The other one is the Dome one. The one where he's like in the reality show, but he doesn't know it. His whole life's like inside the reality show. Truman Show. Truman Show. That was great.
That's good. Hold on. I feel like I'm forgetting. This is horrible podcasting, but Harry. There's one that. Yes, Man.
Yes, Man?
I enjoyed that movie.
I'll have to look that up. I may have watched
it. I don't know. It's probably not your kind of humor, but.
All right.
I don't even know what your kind of humor is, Doug, to be honest with you. How do you
like smart
Dumb
humor? I like smart humor. Like, yeah. So clever.
Fine.
Well written. I don't like toilet jokes. Then lame.
You've never laughed at a fart before in your life? I don't believe you.
Maybe when I was 12, sure. Not when I'm 40 something, or now 50. All right. Let's answer the question. Favorite underrated sport? Let's just say favorite sports movie. I don't know what underrated means.
Okay,
underrated
so
by
favorite
who?
Sports movie is Remember the Titans, and it's not close. Most underrated sports movie, I would probably go. What's the one about the basketball team in El Paso? The college basketball team. What was it? Glory Road.
You're not talking. Was it a documentary kind of thing?
No, it's a movie.
No. Okay.
I would say Glory Road.
I don't think I've seen that.
Blades of Glory is another good
Blades
sports
of
movie.
Glory. Wasn't that the Will Ferrell one?
Yes, that is the figure
with the guy one. What the heck's Dodgeball. That movie? Yeah. Oh no, I was thinking wasn't he with the guy from kind of with the big afro hair? It was a big like cult classic cheap movie. I can't think of it. The guy with his uncle throws the football, you know, over the mountain.
I mean, are we counting Napoleon Dynamite as a
Napoleon Dynamite? Movie? No, but Napoleon Dynamite guy was the one in Blades of Glory with Will Ferrell, wasn't he?
Is it him?
Did I get that wrong? I thought it was the Napoleon Dynamite guy.
I don't know. I haven't watched those movies in so long.
I watched that movie one time as well. Yeah, this is horrible. All right, favorite underrated sports movie. I liked. Gosh, I go way back. Like, obviously, Hoosiers was a big one for me growing up as a kid, as was The Natural. But I would say my favorite sports movie of all time is probably, why am I blanking on the name of all these movies? The cornfield one, Kevin Costner.
Oh, Jesus. A baseball movie?
Field of Dreams.
Wait, hold on. If we're talking baseball movies, Sandlot.
Sandlot's pretty good. Yeah. Field of Dreams. I love Bull Durham's great. Going way back in the day. You've seen Bull Durham, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm not five. Like I've watched.
That movie's old. That movie's old. Really, all those movies are old. You're a young guy. I don't ever know.
I feel like you're not giving me any credit for
underrated,
having.
Underrated though. I don't know about underrated. It's hard to predict.
Hey, underrated stuff because like I just enjoy what I enjoy. And I don't really care what other people think about it. Like, I guess you're probably.
I'll say one that's probably underrated that I really liked. Another like Kevin Costner baseball movie. I don't remember the name of it, but he's like a pitcher, like throwing a perfect game. And so the whole game, he's kind of like talking in his head. And he has these flashback moments and whatnot. And he's like an aging, you know, he's like a veteran pitcher, probably in his last season, 40 years old or something. And he's throwing, I can't remember what the name of the movie is, which is terrible. But
I'm just glad that you haven't said Rudy because that movie sucks. I don't care.
Oh my God. I loved it as a kid. But
yeah, I'm sure because you could identify. You were a flanker.
Also, it kind of ruined it for me when you come to find out half of it's just total bullshit that Rudy made up.
Yeah.
Yeah. That kind of ruined it after that.
That movie made me hate Notre Dame.
I hated Notre Dame before that movie, and it didn't make me like Notre Dame. But, yeah. All right, let's move on. Without knowing the landing spot, which QB will have the better career? Bo Nix, Michael Penix, or J.J. McCarthy?
Well, JJ's out in my book. Like, I'm not picking him.
I mean, too. Me too.
And so I'd probably say Michael Penix. But if the 49ers drafted, I just have this weird fixation. I don't know if it's actually like a good call or not, but I have this weird fixation on Kyle Shanahan and Bo Nix. I think it would be a really good pairing, but I don't know.
So much about these guys really depends on where they go. Right, like where they go, what the organization is like, what the coach is like, and they put them in position to succeed. Right, especially guys like this. Right, like they're not the Caleb Williams. Right, they're not the surefire can't miss prospect. Right, so you know, are they going to be put in a position to succeed or not? And that, well, I think so. I think the landing spot is, so without knowing the landing spot is the question, but the landing spot is so critical to answering the question.
Yeah, but I think basically what he's asking is, who do you gun your head? Do you think that who would you draft? Who's the best prospect? I'd probably take Penix, but I don't think it's. I think situation matters a lot because the type of offense I run would also greatly impact the call I make on that.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, that's probably a good pick. All right, Max says, explain why you are so high on Daylon Austin and who he will have to beat out to see the field. Great show. Thanks, guys. Well, he'll have to beat out Brandon Johnson or not because they're both play.
I think they're both going to play a lot, but I think Brandon Johnson will be the starter, and I think he'll be the backup at nickel. Why do I like him? Well, he's long. He's really twitchy. He's fluid. He can cover. He's a corner by trade or like by skill set. So he's not like one of those guys that you put in the nickel because he's too small to play safety or not fluid enough to play corner. Like Daylon Austin could very easily play corner for us, but he also has like a really good physical skill set as a tackler, as a box run defender. I would think that he's probably, other than Javon Holland, the best man-to-man cover guy that we've played in the nickel in a long time.
Yeah. I agree with all that. I think there's a reason that Oregon moved him from outside inside. I think there's a lot of reasons. He's going to show us all why that is this year.
Yeah.
See, we had a good one. All right. Crunchy asks, your honest thoughts on what Nick Saban said to Congress. Well, this was a month ago, and I don't remember what Nick Saban said to Congress all that well. Do you?
Yeah. No. And honestly, I didn't even know he talked to Congress. This is the kind of thing that this is your wheelhouse. This is not.
I know. I think it was, I think he made some, you know, typical Nick Saban, you know, comments about, you know, NIL's ruining the game. We got to get control of this. We need, you know, blah, blah, blah. We need guardrails, you know, some of that sort of stuff. And he's right and he's wrong at the same time. You know, Nick Saban is certainly listened to whenever he says something about the sport of football, but also, usually when he says something about the sport of football is because he has self-serving interests, as we all do. So he's trying to influence people to make changes that benefit him and his program, at least historically before he retired, obviously.
His program
doesn't mean he's necessarily wrong, but it also doesn't mean he's necessarily right. And I think you have to look at that through, you know, everybody who's speaking, right? You got to look at it through the lens of what, you know, how are they personally invested in this conversation and how this is going. So I didn't take a whole lot of, I don't remember what his exact comments were, but I remember saying, oh yeah, okay, that's Nick. I mean, saying, you know, saying what he said, but you know, it's somewhat self-serving, which I don't blame him for, but it's also not like I'm going to take up and go like, oh my God, Nick Saban said this, so we should definitely do it. No. He has a bias just like the rest of us.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would probably assume that generally he has like a pretty good idea of what would be best for the game, but doesn't mean I would agree 100%.
I mean, when he, you know, 15 years ago, when he was railing against the you know, trying to get the sport to crack down on
the spread offense,
tempo spread offenses, that wasn't for the good of the game. That was for what? That was to benefit him. There was no good of the game in that. That was BS.
Yeah,
he was struggling to beat those offenses at that time, and that was before he decided to join them. So he wanted to legislate them away so he could keep his advantage of having his big trench monsters and power running game. Like, let's be real about it. There was no good of the game in that.
Yeah, but then he hired the right coordinators and started doing it, and they did it really well.
Yeah, because he didn't get his way. He didn't get his way, so he's like, okay, well, fine, I'll just do it better because I can get better players and better coaches.
Yeah.
But, like, if he had gotten his way, it wouldn't have been for the good of the game. It would have been to benefit him.
Yeah.
All right. Ballard of Mayhem. There is a bill in the State Senate of Oregon to be passed, and it did pass, by the way, that players and coaches cannot be punished for any NCAA violations regarding NIL. What is going to change when that passes, and how does that affect Oregon? So I talked about this, I think, on a previous podcast, but the state of Oregon passed a bill that basically said the school can facilitate coaches, whatever, can facilitate NIL deals, they can be involved in them, and no school, no, in Oregon, no coach, no school, no person, no player, nobody can be penalized by the NCAA or anyone else for anything regarding NIL. It was kind of a carte blanche, and also it was historically back to whenever NIL first started, like in 2021. So it was kind of a carte blanche, you know, get out of jail free card, you can't touch us for anything. It seemed like a big deal for a little while, and then basically now this is status quo across the entire country anyway due to lawsuits, so it probably isn't going to change much at all, and not affect Oregon much at all more than everyone else has already been affected, because the NCAA is basically waving the white flag on trying to put in place any kind of guardrails or restrictions, because every time they do, they've been absolutely decimated in court. So I think it's a good law. I'm glad it passed. It, you know, it might help afford Oregon some protections for some past things if somebody were to try to come after them. But at this point, I think everybody's playing under the wild, wild west rules that we keep talking about. And then everyone has the same advantages and disadvantages. So if you hear people out there in other states talking about, well, our NIL bill is too restrictive. No, it's bullshit. The NCAA is not doing anything to anybody. They've been shut down in court. Everybody has the same rules in every state. And now it's just about what your program can do and is willing to do and what resources you can bring to bear from an NIL perspective. And if you can't or don't or won't, then that's on you and your program and your fan base. And it's not on your state lawmakers, because that's bullshit. Looking at you, Washington.
I figured that this was directed at somebody.
There's been some people up north squawking about how their state law has limited their ability to play the NIL game, which first of all was bullshit, has been bullshit from day one. I've looked at their state law. It's basically been identical to Oregon's for the entire time the NIL's been in place. It's a total bullshit cop-out excuse. And now it doesn't matter anyway, because the courts struck down all the restrictions. So everybody's on the same playing field.
That makes sense.
All right, QB, I don't think there's any more questions. Oh, wait, nope, that's it. That's it.
Well, we'll have to get some more for the next episode. I've got some good topic ideas. I think we've got some good. Well, the spring game is going to be coming up too, so we'll have that to talk about. But I'm just, man, I think recruiting is about to start really going crazy. I saw a couple names at running backs that we're probably going to start recruiting pretty heavily today that make me excited. So I'm very much looking forward to what the next couple weeks have to offer. Spring game, the recruiting surrounding the spring game. And then finally going to get eyes on and have like open, honest conversations about all the growth that this team has had this offseason.
Yeah, it's definitely going to start kicking into gear here pretty quick, right? Between, obviously spring game and then all the other activities that start happening in recruiting between now and June and then into the summer. And then before you know it, you know, fall camp's here and we're talking football again. And then games are here and we're going to games again. And one note, like if you guys haven't seen this, Oregon has blown the doors off their season ticket sales. They had over 95% re-up rate from last year's, and they sold an additional over 10,000 season tickets above and beyond what they had sold last year. I went in and looked a couple days ago, right before I think they were going to stop selling them, and they're basically sold out. Like obviously they have to hold back some seats for visiting fans. They have to hold back some seats for recruiting. They'll hold back a small amount for single game and whatnot. But from a standpoint of the available inventory for season tickets, it's gone. It's gone. So they basically said there will not even be single game tickets probably for any of the Big Ten games. They're selling like a two game package for the Portland State, Boise State, or whatever the hell our FCS game is this year. It's not Portland State.
Idaho,
yeah. So Idaho, Boise State, two game package. But beyond that, there won't be single game tickets available outside on the initial, right? You can get secondary market, of course, but whatever single game inventory is available will go to season, you know, because season ticket holders have a right to buy single game tickets before the general public, and whatever small amount might be available for those five Big Ten games will be gone before they ever go on sale to the general public. So obviously, QB, what this tells me is that we really should have stayed in the Pac-12 and signed a streaming deal. This Big Ten move was a horrible mistake.
Yeah, no, playing better teams in front of more people on bigger networks with higher stakes is definitely worse for the program than playing on Apple TV +++ minus explanation point against Oregon State and Cal.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what this program was thinking. Wanted to sell that many more season tickets. It's a terrible mistake, QB. I don't know what they were thinking.
Bad business. Truly.
Bad business.
More money is bad business.
Yeah, that extra $1 million, I'm sure they're going to take in ticket sales was just terrible.
It's probably more than that.
Yeah, I haven't done the math, but...
I mean, I used to know this number off top. I think it was like $20 million, $21 million a year was for the program. I don't know if that included basketball. I think that was just football sales, ticket sales. And I'm sure they'll be closer to $25, $30 million.
Okay, so 10,500 times five games, it's 52,500. What do you think the average, maybe 150 a ticket average?
Sure.
That's 7.9 million.
Yeah. Yeah, so we...
That's more than we have to pay the Pac-2 in penalties this year. So we've already made our money back.
Yeah. I think that Ohio State game will be the most expensive ticket in the history of Oregon football.
I also think that will set the all-time attendance record.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I think it'll demolish the all-time attendance. Like I think it'll be like 62. Like, what's the record right now? It's like 60,000 something.
I think it's a hair over 60, yeah.
Yeah, I think it'll be like 62,000.
Yeah, it's... Well, I don't know if they can get that many in there legally, but whatever their legal limit is, they're going to hit it.
Well, what was it that they used to do with those? Like they had those like wooden.
Yeah, they have. They still have them in the corners. They're basically they put like some temporary seating in there, and then they sell standing room tickets, right? So you get to stand around the berm up against the rail, but you don't actually have a seat. So I'm sure they'll sell as many of those as they possibly can as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I might try to.
They're gonna have to expand the stadium, though.
That's coming. That's coming.
You're hearing about that over the weekend?
I aired. It's coming. It's definitely in play. It's basically the timeline right now is they're currently moving the road that runs south of Autzen that's going to allow for the space for the expanded practice facilities. That's underway right now. Their plan is to break ground on the new practice facility in January. And then basically all of next season, they will not, right now, if you know the Autzen complex, right now they have the indoor practice facility. And then outside of that, they have two full turf fields that are outside that they primarily, Dan does not like to practice indoors. Unless it's absolutely necessary, he will always practice outside. One, because he has two fields to work with, and it's really important. It's part of those getting more reps thing that we talked about. Because they can four spot drills. They can have four, you can have up to four, basically four 11 on 11s going at the same time because they have two fields and they split them in half, right? So he doesn't, Mario loved to practice indoors. If there was a hint of a cloud in the sky, Mario would be inside. But Dan hates to be inside. So unless there's some reason they're practicing inside for it, the weather is just so atrocious it can't be productive, or they want to simulate, you know, something inside, you know, for a particular reason, then they'll be practicing outside. So sorry to digress. So those two outdoor fields will be offline while they're building the new practice facility, because it's basically being built on that footprint. And then so for all of next spring ball, a year from now, as well as fall, they will have to practice both. They'll have Autzen and the current indoor facility available for practice, but they won't have the current outdoor fields available. So that'll kind of be a 1 year blip where they'll probably practice in Autzen a lot, as well as the current indoor. And then the hope is that the new indoor will open after, you know, sometime in 2026, in time for spring ball in 2026, or at least by fall. And by that point, then the new outdoor fields will be back and up and running as well. So that's the plan for all of that. And then what I was told is that then they will go right into whatever the Autzen construction plan is right after that. So if that all wraps up in early 2026, then you could imagine them potentially starting with the Autzen, whatever Autzen work is going to be done right after the 2025 season, right? Because that would be, if your goal is to try to get it in between the two seasons, right? You have to start right after the last game of the 2025 season, and then you got basically, you know, 9 months to get it done. So I think that's the timeline we're looking on. So in the best case scenario, I think you'd be looking at whatever Autzen improvements would be in place for the 2026 season, but, you know, it could be 27. We'll see.
Wait,
or it could be a little bit of both. Yeah.
Are you excited to go watch Oregon play Northwestern on a practice field next year?
Well, I won't be going to that game, but you know, the setting looks pretty cool, right on the lakeside there. Will the wind be blowing at like 40 miles an hour off the lake?
I'll probably. If I had to guess, that's probably a safe assumption.
That's not this coming season, right? It's the one after.
I think it's not this coming. It's the following. It's 2025.
Yeah.
I think that's cool.
Yeah, it is kind of cool still. You know what I am excited about 2025 is going 12-0, because that schedule is very favorable for Oregon in that season.
I don't even know that schedule. I'll look at that.
All right, QB. Unless you want to look it up while we're talking, we'll call this an episode.
No, I think we're good.
All right. We will, I think with the Sunday thing's probably working for now for spring. So we will we'll be back at you in 1 week with our next episode, and we'll talk to you all then. Thanks for listening.